So we're going to take us out of recess because, again, we're really tight on schedule, and I've asked my Forest Department. They have two 30-minute sections to move them to two 40-minute sessions, and hopefully we'll get close to back on time, but we will take the extra time necessary to do the other hearing. So we're going to start with our informational hearing on forest health. So, Doug, if you want to come up and start, we can get going, and then we'll move from there. Thank you.
I beg your pardon? It looks like it. Thank you. I recognize it. I took that picture. Okay, shall we begin?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Chair Roblin, member of the committee, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. We're going to be continuing the focus on forests this morning a little bit, talking about particularly about forest health, particularly on the state's influence on the health of Oregon's federal forest lands. And I have brought some collaborators and work friends here, a panel of folks who have helped shape the state's strategy and the state's posture and work on how we influence the pace and scale of management on national forest lands. And so you'll recall that the state of Oregon, through the Department of Forestry, is working intently with local communities and with our federal agencies to improve the management, the resiliency of federal forest lands statewide. We refer to this package in our budget. It's the Collaborative Support Package. It's the 2.88. You probably have heard that. It's kind of the shorthand for how the state is supporting the increase of pace and scale of operations on federal land. It's about a $3 million investment for the for this current biennium with lottery funds. And we're going to talk in some, we're going to give you some very specific ways in which we're implementing that. And you're going to hear a little bit about how that's making a difference for Oregon communities. So really, we've got about 20, 25 minutes here. I want to just give you an update on the impact of the work. I'm going to start out by just reminding us why it's important. We'll hear from Brett. Chad Davis, who's our chief administrator on the work, is going to describe the key elements of the program. Tom Insko, who you heard from a little bit earlier, member of our Board of Forestry, is going to talk about what's happening in his community and how these trend lines in this work is influencing investment decisions. If we have time, at your discretion, we may talk a little bit about biomass and its role there. That also is an item that we could bring back at your discretion if that's what you'd like to do. And then I'll close with some thoughts about what's next on federal forests. So for me, I guess I want you to maybe Brett could click in one here.
Let's do click this. Into one slide.
Yeah.
I'll manage
for
you.
Let's just click in one. Just one. For me, I want you to know why this is important, why it's important for Oregon to be working on influencing the management of Oregon's federal forests. You heard it a little bit before. It's important because 60% of Oregon's 30 million acres of forest land are owned and managed by the federal government. To achieve goals and outcomes that are defined by Congress and that are enacted in a set of federal rules that have been translated by the federal agencies into management plans. And so the work that we're going to describe today is all within the context of the existing federal policies and authorities that are contained in the National Forest Management Act and the National Environmental Policy Act and other enacted federal legislation. So we're playing within the rules of engagement that are out there right now. There's a whole other conversation about those rules of engagement and how can we modernize, update to deal with the current situation and conditions that we have. How can we look at modernizing some of those federal authorities? That's a different discussion than the 2.88, but it's alive and well in the governor's office with our Board of Forestry and with the department. We're preparing a set of recommendations, the state is, to refresh the authorities, and it's a conversation we've begun with the delegation. But that's a different strategy, really involving updating those authorities. So here's the problem: we've got this confluence of conditions and choices and policies that's led to a situation where our federal forests in Oregon—that's 60% of all of our forest lands, particularly on the east side—are in a compromised condition, particularly vulnerable to catastrophic fire, to insect and disease outbreaks. The next map here, I'm going to ask Chad to go back one slide. There we go. This map depicts ownership. The colors are really about ownership here. The federal forests in Oregon are in green. The yellow lands that are marked yellow on this map, coated yellow, are private industrial forest lands. The red lands are lands that are owned by family forest landowners, small woodland owners, typically smaller parcels. And so we're talking on federal forests here. You can see that the Cascades, southwest Oregon, much of eastern Oregon, are owned and managed by the federal government. And these lands represent a significant existing value and potential in terms of their social, economic, environmental resilience, jobs, products, habitat, clean air, clean water, recreation, all the things that we want from a multiple use managed forest. But there's this set of legal challenges, of congressional gridlock, of polarized opinion, and outdated policies that have conspired to produce a set of conditions on these federal, much of these federal forests that not only do not leverage the potential that's there, but actually work against the rural communities that are struggling to survive. And in many cases, this also exports risks to adjacent non-federal forest lands as well. So the state, through the governor's office and the Board of Forestry and with your leadership, we've been thinking about how do we make a difference here. And communities are engaging through local collaboratives on this question as well, and that's what we want to talk to you about today. I'm going to ask Brett to give you some perspective from the governor's office, and then when I close here at the end, I'd like to focus for a moment on a new authority that's been provided to the state forester, state foresters across the country through the Farm Bill called the Good Neighbor Authority, and it really defines what I'm thinking about for 15-17, what we've been talking and thinking about, and I'd like to close with some thoughts on that. Brett?
Okay. Thanks, Doug. And thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brett Brownscombe, Natural Resource Policy Advisor to the Governor. I wanted to be brief and just mainly because I think the value of the testimony of those succeeding me is more substantive and probably may perhaps of more value to some more detailed background on the issue. But I did want to touch briefly on the continued importance of this issue to the governor. I think many, if not most, people in Oregon would struggle to identify the names of all the national forests in the state and certainly the names of all the BLM districts. But it is the condition on these lands, and like Doug alluded to, these lands dominate our forested landscape that affects virtually every interest in the state. So I'd like to rattle off some examples of the affected public that's touched by this issue, and these are based on real-world examples of people who live in Senate and House Senate districts such as yours, and that have come to my attention over the past 2 years. So first off, there's the rural resident whose community has is adjacent to federal lands and who has seen declining school enrollment and jobs as mills have declined in their community. Second, there's the John Day, Oregon, or Willamette Valley resident that's wondering whether they should send their kid to school or whether they should go outside and spend much time in the outdoors because of excessive smoke in the air and public health concerns related to that, which yesterday was a fairly obvious example of that and an interesting backdrop for this hearing. Or there's the school board or superintendent or rural hospital that's looking to reduce its energy costs and convert its heating system from a fossil fuel oil source to a woody biomass source that has ties to forest health restoration. Or there's the tree-hugging, woodpecker-loving environmentalist who wants to know that they can still go and hike or recreate on lands with wild natural habitat that supports healthy fish and wildlife, or just know that these places exist. There's also the mill owner or worker or logger or building architect or the traded commodity sector worker who is looking for the next opportunity or wondering if there will exist additional opportunities tied to federal forest management and wood products. There's the Portland resident who just had a summer float trip canceled because access had been closed due to wildfire, or the Sisters, Oregon resident whose business just lost its clothing inventory because it's impossible to wash the smoke from the fabric. And finally, there's the state, and not to mention the nation, where the general fund and its taxpayers are paying increasing millions to deal with costs tied to fire suppression activities. So the first point here is that this issue on federal forest health is not just a rural issue, it's a statewide issue, and it's one that affects citizens of many stripes, whether they live next to or adjacent to federal forest land or not. It's the current conditions on these lands that expose or threaten all of the above interests that I just mentioned, and it's addressing these underlying causal conditions with proactive management that is the key to finding solutions to the symptoms that are evidenced by the examples that I just rattled off. The second point and reason from the governor's perspective that this issue is so important is it's not just an issue of great challenge, which it certainly is, but it's also an issue of great opportunity. And I think some of the hopefully some of the executive order presentations that you heard spoke to that. We'll hear more about that in a minute with Chad to my right and Tom Insko, who's here, as well as Marcus Kaufman and staff from DEQ on woody biomass. But the broad point is this issue is one that connects economic, social, and ecological interests in a very significant way. It's one that can provide the often sought-after triple bottom-line solution that is hard to achieve. And it ties to the governor and first lady's interests in rural prosperity. But it also connects to Oregon prosperity and our state's identity, both its past, its present, and its future. So importantly, we are recognized as a state as a growing leader on this issue. And as you all well know, our history has been defined in part by the storyline around the timber wars. But our leadership, and it's because of our leadership on locally grown efforts to move beyond these timber wars through collaboration, that the state has become identified nationally as such a leader. We now have three national forests where there's been no litigation for 7 years, and that's because of the work of the local forest collaborative groups. And it's also because of your leadership, the state's leadership, as demonstrated by the legislature's advancement of the $2.85 million investment in 2013 around a new kind of constructive state-federal partnership tied to increasing the pace and scale of management work on federal forest land. So building on this momentum is very much in the governor's interest because he believes broadly it's in the state's interest. And I know he looks forward to working with you and the legislative body as a whole across party lines on the next opportunities for state leadership in this area, which hopefully we'll get to a bit at the end of the panel here. And lastly, I wanted to close with the governor recently became chairman of the Western Governors Association, which puts him in a position to likely become the chair of Western Governors Association in 2015. So through that position, I know he looks forward to working with other Western governors on meaningfully addressing some of the policy issues and the federal forest policies that need attention beyond the box that we're in right now in order to give us some more space to grow the momentum and grow the collaborative solutions around increasing the pace and scale of federal forest management that we have today and building those into something that is much more robust, much more statewide, and really, I think, positions Oregon as more of a leader on this issue than we already are now. So with that, I'll stop, and I think yield to you, Chad, and the other panelists, just being mindful of time. But thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Bartsugar, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chad Davis. At the Department of Forestry, as Doug mentioned, I serve as project manager on your $2.88 million investment in Federal Forest Health. I'm appreciative of this opportunity today to report to you on how we focus the state's investment to strengthen collaborative agreement for active management on federal forests and to increase the pace and scale of actual forest health treatments. At the highest level, the strategy we've put into place is targeted and based on a premise that a strong federal-state partnership can meaningfully improve the status quo of forest management across the state of Oregon. And our strategy is highly leveraged, both in terms of commitment, as evidenced by the Forest Service's willingness to actually partner with the state, and in terms of funding, as evidenced by the obligation of an additional $10 million of federal funds in the same geographic focus as the state's investments. As a result of our investment at the state level and our targeted approach, local forest collaboratives are maturing and increasing the scope of their agreements. As an example, the Blue Mountain Forest Partners are using a state-awarded grant to retool their collaborative process to match the increased pace and scale of restoration on the Malheur National Forest as expected from them by their leadership in the regional office. Secondly, the Forest Service is refining its approach to project-level planning, and this effort is actually buoyed by state investments. The Forest Service's regional office made a 3-year commitment last year to fund a dedicated planning team for large-scale projects across the Blue Mountains regions. State funds are being strategically invested to leverage even more process change within that team's purview. I'll give you an example of what that looks like on the ground. That planning team's first project is a 90,000-acre project called the Lower Joseph Creek Project in Wallowa County. We expect a decision on this project in December of this year. So in less than a year, we're going to have a 90,000-acre project. On Lower Joseph, this particular project, state funds are being used to complete heritage resource surveys. We, with our Forest Service partners, have identified this survey protocol for potential cost and time reductions in obtaining the information. The planning team is also charged to deliver two other projects over the next 2 years, the third of which should amount to roughly 500,000 acres, a large-scale project, and it is due in 2016. In support of this very large project, state funds are being used to evaluate the cost-effectiveness of using LIDAR data across a large geography as compared to the kind of the status quo method of stand-by-stand, what they call forest inventory data. All of this is evidence that the state's investment and subsequent policy efforts are helping to advance planning efficiencies, cost savings, and the scale of projects that relate to restoring our federal forests. And finally, all of these combined efforts, including public and private investment, are changing the direction of important metrics such as local employment and timber supply. As shown in the chart on the screen here, we are seeing a significant increase in timber availability, in particular, as represented here on the Malheur National Forest, as compared to the last 10 years. State funds out of this 2.88 package are actually being used to extend ODF seasonal positions to conduct layout activities on the Ochoco, the Malheur, and the Umatilla National Forest in the Blue Mountains region. So these were projects that have already been completed through environmental analysis, but just didn't have the resources to actually get them to a sale date. As this chart shows, the volume of timber actually awarded, which is the yellow line on this graph, has increased in each of the last 3 years. Most recently, that includes an almost 200% increase in the past year due to the award of a 10-year stewardship contract. Just 2 years ago, Malheur Lumber Company had announced it would close due to a lack of timber supply. Today, the mill's buying logs, and it has indicated their intent to reinvest in improving its milling capacity. While difficult to plot as an empirical relationship with this increase in timber supply, unemployment in Grant and Harney counties declined by 1% from July of 2013 to July of 2014. That decline in a very rural part of our state outpaces the statewide number. Given the short window and response time for some of these bulkier metrics like unemployment and timber supply, anecdotal evidence makes a much stronger case about the positive impacts within the local economy. I encourage each of you to call store owners in Grant County and ask them for yourselves. The stories that I've heard when I was over there are pretty impressive. At this point, I think I'm going to exit the panel and hand this over to Mr. Tom Insko, who can speak to the opportunities that these combined state, federal, and private investments are yielding for the forest sector.
Chair Roblin.
Yes.
Sure. Thank you. Before you exit, I'd like to pose a question. These are all dry side collaboratives, and I'm interested in the potential for the collaborative model to be brought over to the west side. I understand there's one developing down in southwestern Oregon, and what the challenges are that seem to be precluding it from happening on the west side.
Yeah. Thanks for the question. Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Borsugger, and
McEwen. I'm sorry.
Representative
I came
McEwen.
Without my name tag.
Facial recognition would help.
Here, you want to be me?
Very good question.
I'll be representative of me.
Okay. Very good question. And
there it is.
In fact, in Oregon, we have 23 forest collaboratives, as been documented by Oregon Solutions. And I was speaking primarily, and the 2.88 package is focused on the east side of Oregon and southwest Oregon. But there are more than one on the wet side or on the west side. What we're seeing is potential traction there. The call for action, the rallying point, if you will, for collaboratives on the east side has no doubt been the historical role of fire on that landscape, which is obviously a little different west of the Cascades. There are habitat issues. There are other things that could function as that call for action on the east side collaboratives, including the socioeconomic conditions of our communities. And I think we're starting to see some uptick and traction on the west side as well. We are not as, but be very clear, we are not as far along from that model on the west side as we are on the east side. We do have to realize that a lot of these east side collaboratives have been working for 5, 6, 10, some in the cases of 10 years. And what we're hoping to do with this package and potentially with a subsequent package is to export those lessons so that startup time and that is not as long as we transition that model over to the west side.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Roblin?
Yes.
Real quick. Representative.
Senator Mack.
We had this yesterday with Bertie. anyways, on the west side collaboratives down in southwest Oregon, the problem is that for whatever reasons, and probably economic reasons, the industry and the environmental community just couldn't seem to get on the same page to get them to get things working, and I hope to see that change in the future, you know. But it seemed to be an economic problem. They just, you know, if you can't get the economics to work, it just simply won't work. And I think that's what we had down there.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to point out, so Tom Itzko is a member of the Board of Forestry. We also have another member of the Board of Forestry. Gary Springer is here. So you have two of our seven Board of Forestry members here in the room.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, committee members, again, my name is Tom Itzko, Inland Area Manager, also member of Board of Forestry, as Doug mentioned. As we think about the investment and leadership that the state has taken in business, robust performance metrics tied to meaningful outputs as a primary method for monitoring success. I think a question I ask frequently of Chad as a Board of Forestry member, and I'm sure you're asking, is what's the return on investment here? Why should we be considering more? Chad and others have shared some compelling evidence in terms of this chart showing some of that, but I'd also like to share from a private industry side how that money's been leveraged. We've heard about how our federal partners have. But I want to go back so that we remember where we were. Just a few years ago, industry was nearly in collapse in eastern Oregon. Malheur Lumber had announced closure. Candidly, less publicly, Boise Cascade, I was in serious planning of basically eliminating all of our infrastructure down to a single facility. Today, we employ about 650 employees in eastern Oregon. So significant difference today relative to what we were seriously contemplating back then. Currently, Boise Cascade is adding jobs and investing in operations in eastern Oregon due in part to the leadership and investment by this state. I testified earlier this year that we had recently added 70 jobs at our lumber mill and particleboard plant near LeGrand. Earlier today, I spoke of a major investment in new processing capabilities in our Elgin facilities that we will be completing mid-year 2015. And we have other investment considerations that are being studied right now to strengthen our other businesses. And again, as I spoke to earlier today, it's about Boise Cascade, my objective is to be in front of the biomass challenge that we have in front of us on the federal forests. And so providing an economic outlet for that as well, because I think if industry is stepping up and ready for that, when it does come, that is going to dramatically increase the likelihood of success. And I'm born and raised in Northeast Oregon. I connect with the rural small communities. My kids are in school there. I was ecstatic. My wife works in the LeGrand School District. I was ecstatic that we were adding a first grade teacher because numbers were higher than they had anticipated. And when I look at just Boise Cascade, in the last year we've hired over 200 employees, many of those young new families, because the jobs that we offer and what's really offered through this state investment are jobs that are paying in excess of $50,000. These are family wage jobs that are going to help develop our communities, return that vitality that I think our governor is committed to, you're committed to. And so I really hope you look at where we were, how drastic it was, where we've come. That significant return on a pretty minor investment by the state, yet significant leadership from the state. And then as we consider more, we've got a lot of challenge in front of us. I still have four of those five manufacturing facilities running at less than full capacity. That's a challenge. It's hard to invest in our facilities in that situation. But it's an opportunity, because I can tell you right now, if we had the supply, the markets are there, if we had the supply, I could add 150 jobs today in Northeast Oregon. That capacity is already there. That doesn't require additional investment. And so we've just got tremendous opportunity to continue to build on what we've already started to do. So I look forward to working with the state, the governor, and you in continuing to invest in the future of rural Oregon. Thank you all in there.
Thank you.
Doug? So we have a couple of other folks who we could talk, kind of open up the biomass discussion a little bit.
Only thing I would say is you've got about 25 minutes, a little longer, to get that in the fire season.
Okay.
So you decide how to plan your time.
Right.
It's your 25 minutes.
Okay, very good. The biomass topic is an important one. Would you entertain the possibility kind of a focused discussion at a later time?
Oh, absolutely. No, I really want to do biomass, and I would be glad to look at even in January as the biomass.
Biomass, yeah.
Okay.
It's me, certainly.
All right.
And December. Yeah, we could do December. We'll carve out some time for it.
Okay. So we'll work together on that. So that puts me. So we're gonna wrap here on the federal forest health piece, with apologies to my colleagues who were prepared to do that. We will pick that up.
And we appreciate you being here.
Yep.
So thank you.
Yeah, me too. All right. So so as we move forward, you've heard where we've come from, how we're investing our funds, what we're focused on, some neat things happening in particularly on the east side in these communities. As we think about 15-17, we're taking a look, very very careful look, at something called the Good Neighbor Authority, which is a new authority that is embedded. It's not new, but it's updated. It was embedded in the federal farm bill, and basically the Good Neighbor Authority gives the state forester the ability to manage federal projects when there's an agreement in place to manage federal land. And so the idea is, if there are projects that have gone through the collaborative process, that are approved, that are ready to go, that the Forest Service does, or the BLM, do not have the capacity, the resources, the know-how, the depth to put together, we can actually do that, and we can accomplish the social, economic, and environmental components there. So we're looking carefully at that. The projects, again, have to meet all the existing federal process and policy requirements, but it gives us an opportunity to leverage federal resources and to move some agreed-upon projects forward, thereby increasing the pace and scale of restoration and management. As Brett had mentioned, the work that we're doing here with the 2.88 has gained the interest of the delegation and broader. At the national level, the U.S. Forest Service Chief Tidwell and others are focused on what we're doing here in Oregon. I think that with the governor moving into the WGA chair next month, I become the chair of the Council of Western State Foresters, and this is with the West being largely with a significant amount of federal forest land ownership. There's a lot of energy around that. And so as we look to 15-17, we're working with the governor's office, and we're going to be bringing forward an ODF budget request working with the governor's office builds on what we've done so far, and that keeps pushing the trend lines in the directions that you've seen. I know that I'll be telling you more about that in the full session, what that's going to look like. And in the meantime, we do have a number of you have are going to be joining us. We have a tour to look at the Deschutes Collaborative and look at this issue on the ground in Central Oregon on October 22nd. Most of the folks that you've heard from this morning are going to be with us for the day, and really encourage you to join in that if that works for you. So I think we'll, if there's questions, otherwise we'll rest the federal forest piece here, and I think we're going to talk about fire.
Okay.
Arnie?
Yes.
Could I get a just quick question on the forester?
A question, yes.
It is a question.
Okay.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Arnie,
yes.
Roblin. So I, you know, listening to this the discussion about collaboratives, so does the federal forest lands, you know, and their goals and how they manage their forest play into that? Because I know the BLM manages their forest different than the national forest, and the national forest itself, I think, has different management goals for their forests on the west side, like they manage for late successional reserve forests, and so their commercial operations are sort of restricted to commercial thinning as opposed to other lands. So does that have an impact on the success of the collaboratives, the different models of the forest, national forest, and how they, and BLM lands, how they manage those?
Yes, Chair Roblin, Representative Holvey. So they are, there's a common set of federal authorities that all the federal lands are managed under, and each agency does have slightly different management goals and objectives, just like we do on state lands, just like private lands do. I think on the Bureau, so the collaborative process is not defined in law or in process or in statute. It really exists extra, you know, kind of beyond those authorities, and it's this method of trying to gain enough UAS, understanding, acceptance, and support that projects, agreed upon projects, can go forward. The Forest Service has kind of pioneered this. The BLM is looking at, particularly in Southwest Oregon, is experimenting with the collaborative process. But again, there's no, they don't have a playbook that says this is what you need to do, and that it has an intersection with these other federal authorities. So as a result of that, the experience on the ground is not uniform. It's basically where collaboratives have formed and happened, it's been the economy and it's been the people face-to-face that have been able, have said, you know, this is, we need to find a way to work together. I believe that, you know, that the BLM is very hopeful about being able to kind of catch up with where the Forest Service has been in their use of collaboratives, and I see they look at it as a cornerstone absent some broader change to the underlying authorities.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to ask Nancy Hirsch, the chief of our Fire Protection Division, to join us up here, and we're going to switch gears a little bit, but these topics are related. As we know, to talk a little bit about fire. We're going to give you an update on the fire season, which it's not as smoky in Salem today as it was yesterday. It was kind of a perfect backdrop. The fire season continues to push us and challenge us today. We do have multiple fires underway across the state. You saw the tragic news about the fire in Weed, south of the Oregon border, when 100 structures lost there last night. These conditions in Northern California are not unlike the conditions that we have in Western Oregon right now. In fact, yesterday was what we call a high Haynes Index day. The conditions were ripe. Conditions are ripe today and will likely be for some time. That a fire starts, it's going to go. And in a minute, Nancy's going to give you an overview of this summer's fire activity and an understanding of the fiscal consequences as well. We were before the E-Board subcommittee yesterday morning talking about our insurance policy, and we'll be visiting that here this morning. But I wanted to just set the stage for you with some opening themes. All of you know that, you know, ODF, we have 16 million acres of fire protection responsibility. We're the biggest fire department in Oregon. By statute and by reputation, we're known for aggressively fighting fires, and we control the vast majority majority of fires that we do fight. Forest landowners are a really key component and partner in Oregon's wildfire protection system. We refer to it as the complete and coordinated system. They provide half the funding. They bring a lot of know-how, expertise, muscle, equipment, and other resources to the table. So we came into this fire season 14 after a very challenging fire season of 13. It was the most costly last year, the most costly year we've ever experienced in the fire business in Oregon. Nancy's going to talk about the forest and the drought conditions that set that up. But when this season began, the conditions hadn't improved. In fact, they had gotten worse. We had an early start to this fire season with two major interface fires that burned in and around homes. We had wave after wave of lightning through July. And we've been the focal point nationally for up to 40 plus days. We've been the number one priority nationally, and that's not a priority that we would covet, but we've been the centerpiece for fire. We're experiencing now in September, we've got a red flag warning. We've got heat, wind, and low humidity. The result of that is we have two of the worst back, well, these are the two worst of back back-to-back fire seasons that the Oregon Department of Forestry has ever experienced in 103 years. So it has been a very tough fire year, and it was preceded by a very tough fire year. And I'm really proud of the work that we've done, that everyone in the complete and coordinated system has done, particularly given the challenges that we have. We're not out of the woods. We don't see a season-ending rain event on the horizon. With that, I'd ask Nancy to kind of walk us through the 14 fire season and the fiscal piece.
Great. Thanks, Doug. I'm Nancy Hirsch. I'm the Fire Protection Division Chief for Oregon Department of Forestry, and appreciate having the opportunity to briefly provide you an overview of the 2014 fire season. As Doug has already mentioned, the setup for this season was just really a continuation from last year. Limited snowpack, drought persisted, and that basically sets you up for this significant wildfire potential outlook, which was above normal forecasted for this fire season, and obviously that has played out. You might ask yourself the question, well, was ODF ready, and along with our partners and cooperators? And I want to assure you that we were. This slide basically provides you a thumbnail sketch of the three tiers or the three levels of our complete and coordinated fire protection system. The base level, which we call our fire department, the statewide severity resources, which are a whole bunch of aviation resources, and then the insurance policy. And I'll touch on each of those more as they move along here. The first dive a little deeper here is into that statewide severity program. Aviation resources are critical in stopping fires at the smallest possible size. Since the passage of the Wildfire Protection Act in 2013, a very critical bill that you all supported, we have been able to add, and basically the arrows here, the yellow arrows, are showing the resources that we've added since the Wildfire Protection Act was passed. Up there in the corner, the seats, not the seat you sit in, but a single engine air tanker, two of those just out of LeGrand. The type twos are helicopters with medium-sized buckets, about 300 gallons of water. We have a couple different newer detection aircraft. And then lastly, this type three helitac, it's type three helitac crew, which I'm going to highlight here in a moment. Bottom line is, statewide, when you add all of these resources together, you have about 26 different pieces of aviation equipment augmenting frontline firefighters on the ground. Again, the statewide severity resources highlighted in the blue are funded from the Special Purpose Appropriation and the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. So the next question you might have is, how did the system respond? And I want to ensure that you understand that every piece and every element of the system has been exercised this year, in some places at record-breaking points. And I'm starting here with initial attack, because that's really where a majority of our work is accomplished. We have a target of stopping 98% of our fires at 10 acres or less. This year, we are about 94%, just over 900 fires. These are the fires that you don't see in the news, but are key to keeping costs lower and minimizing the loss to the landowners' properties, et cetera, that we protect. Wanted
give you one example of just one day in the life of the Helitech program this summer, and also reflects the life and the day of a normal firefighter that's working for us. On July 13th, this was really a pivotal day for the fire season. This helicopter, the last three numbers there identify 47C, we call that helicopter 47 Charlie, flew for 7.96 hours. All but 6 minutes remained on its available flight time. It began the day supporting the Service Creek incident with mapping and dropping 107 buckets of water. That's its first assignment. Then it was dispatched to its second mission, a quarter-acre fire mid-slope in very nasty rimrock terrain with great potential to be another large fire. After 28 bucket drops, the three Helitech personnel were able to contain this fire at just a couple of acres. Third mission. The crew received their third mission, so they left two people on that fire that they had stopped, picked up two more Helitech, and flew to the vicinity of Monument in Central Oregon. There they reconned about six different fires, confirmed two fires, and put staff on those. Those two fires were in very remote places with the nearest roads 1 to 2 miles away. Helitech personnel were left on these incidents overnight and were able to contain these two fires at a quarter of an acre. Again, it's fire stops like these that reduce fires, keeping them small, reducing costs and loss. Just one more example of a very excellent fire stop just northwest of Bly, Oregon, essentially east of Klamath Falls. This was the Ferguson Fire on July 25th. This fire was burning very actively from the very start, torching, spotting, running fire behavior. I think this photo here in the very corner really displays the type of fire behavior that we saw immediately on hundreds of fires this summer when they ignited and took off. Unfortunately, two structures were impacted, one primary resident lost and one outbuilding. The fire started in a rural subdivision, and these were lost within the first hour. Bottom line, this fire took a lot of coordination with our landowner partners, cooperators, Forest Service, BLM, law enforcement, etc., local fire departments, but the fire was stopped at 200 acres. Let me shift gears and talk to you now about really the fires that you typically hear about that are in the news, and these are the larger fires. This map shows ODF fires through probably the end of August. Basically, the very small dots are fires less than 10 acres. The largest black dots are fires that represent lightning fires over 1,000 acres. You can see a bundle of those, the larger dots here in Central Oregon and down here. The large blue dots are human-caused fires greater than 1,000 acres. Obviously, as Doug has already mentioned, our large fires started early in the summer, in June, and really it's been nonstop with large fires and the utilization of our department incident management teams. They've been exercised 11 times this year. That's more than double the amount they were out last year, although we've seen a significant, you know, less in cost as well as acres lost this year. Want to highlight just a few of these large fires to date. The Moccasin Hill Fire, just north of Klamath Falls, started on July 13th. If you recall, that was the day that I told you the story about the Helitech crew operation in Central Oregon. This was really a pivot point for fire season, not only in Oregon but in Washington, where over 19 fires resulted from 19 large fires resulted on the landscape due to lightning. A few days later, the governor declared a state of emergency, which allowed us to activate the National Guard under Op Plan Smokey. Unfortunately, here at Moccasin Hill, this was a preventable human-caused fire that destroyed 17 structures, as well as 18 outbuildings and numerous other things, such as cars. That's likely the largest destructive incident we've had in a number of years relative to structures loss. Through August, in Oregon, we've received over 83,000 lightning strikes, and again, lightning has been a key for this fire season. The Beaver Complex, which ultimately the largest fire was the Oregon Gulch Fire just east of Ashland. But a complex is essentially when we have a large fire, an incident management team assigned, but they have multiple fires that they're managing. In this case, they had the Salt Creek, Reeves Creek support, as well as some other smaller district fires. But Oregon Gulch was our largest fire. The acres here shows not only the Oregon acres, which was about 26,000 acres, but those acres that also went into California. And so we were in unified command with the state of California on this fire. Very complex, two states, three counties, two BLM districts, two ODF districts, two BLM state offices, a rural fire district, a national monument, and a wilderness. The Rowena Fire. This one was west of the Dalles. I know a number of legislators were very familiar with this and saw this firsthand. For the community of the Dalles, it felt like this fire was in their front yard. Literally, as you sat in the town of Dalles there on the west side, you had about a 3-mile front of fire coming right down into the edge of that town. We had implemented something with one of our teams. All three of our incident management teams were out. We had a team in Central Oregon on the Haystack Fire. They were just wrapping up, and we decided to try to give them one day rest and hold them together so they could respond rapidly because of the conditions that we were in. We didn't have to wait long. They got the call, and we were able to move, and that team was in play in Rowena in 4 to 5 hours, which is huge and critical in the event that this fire was making a run, as you're very familiar with the gorge winds. We were in unified command with the Oregon State Fire Marshal's office here. Unfortunately, there was at least one primary residence lost, as well as some others damaged. We do not do our work alone. We're complete and coordinated. Landowners are with us hand in hand on the front line, not just at initial attack, but extended attack, and providing equipment, fallers, maps, subject matter expertise, and local knowledge at every level. Our cooperators, over 200 rural fire departments. The State Fire Marshal's office has been mobilized as of this morning, about 1 a.m., or actually last night, the fifth time, bringing to bear a number of other task forces to help with structure protection. The National Guard this year mobilized in multiple complexes and incidents, dropped over 1,000 buckets of water, and 1,000 buckets of water, almost 1 million gallons of water. Statewide contractors, also a huge partner in all of this, obviously the aviation contracts, but also the contract crews, over 100 of those, and ODF has utilized 1,700 of those days this year. Looking at stats a little bit before we wrap up, this chart shows the number of fires and acres burned. The blue bar represents the number of fires. You can see here, when we did this, this was more towards the end of August. We're actually very close to over 1,000 as of right now. That's right at about the 10-year average, although acres are significantly up. Lightning has continued to be a key factor. 83% of the acres this year have been caused by lightning. That's a little less than last year, and primarily because we saw some of those human fire starts grow to become large fires this year. Losses. Unfortunately, we do have one firefighter fatality this year that was on a Forest Service fire down in the Southern Cascade Range on June 29th. Firefighter fatality is always an unfortunate loss and definitely impacts the communities. Communities have also been significantly impacted this year. More than 500 homes were evacuated. That's a level 3 evacuation. Obviously, it doesn't reflect the rest of the impacts, as you well got to experience here even in Salem yesterday with the wildfire smoke and the examples that were given earlier by the previous panel. Landowner losses, in particular, JWTR on the Oregon Gulch Fire lost over 19,000 acres, a loss of over $10 million, and doesn't obviously account for the reinvestment to get this forest in this picture green and growing again. Everybody's interested in large fire costs. This reflects obviously the entire funding system, the base level, which comes through our base budget, the 2013-2015 biennium, the second level, the statewide severity, that That is where the special purpose appropriation comes in. We met with the emergency board yesterday. But large fire costs right now are estimated at just over $70 million. When you back out the reimbursements we expect to receive from FEMA, as well as some fire cost recovery from the Forest Service and BLM, we are actually at $45 million, probably just slightly over that through today. And that essentially eats up the insurance policy that we have. General fund has a $10 million portion of the $20 million deductible, and then the insurance policy will pay the $25 million. Just would like to mention for the region, very significant wildfire season for both Oregon and Washington. The total estimated cost is about $425 million for the state of Washington, state of Oregon. That includes Forest Service and BLM fires. So the number here that I'm giving you, about $70 million, is about just over 15% of that. Obviously, next key question for us is the insurance policy for the next fire season. Because of these back-to-back insurance claims, discussion is already underway. The Emergency Fire Cost Committee met on September 2nd. Some insurance representatives were in attendance. And basically, a key question will be, can we renew the policy? They think so because of the longstanding three-decade partnership that we've had there. Once we learn that, though, we will and expect to know that the insurance structure will change. There'll likely be an expectation that this deductible, they may expect an increase in that, as well as a likely increase in the premium. Lastly, fire season is not over. Obviously, Doug has touched on drought conditions persist. We're still expecting above normal temperatures. And with that, you never know when the east wind will be forecasted, and that will keep us in fire season really until we see some substantial rains. As I said, we don't do this work alone. I appreciate the support from many of you, really all the legislature, the governor's office, our landowner partners, cooperators, and contract community. We will continue our discussion not only on the insurance front, but obviously the dollars and the large fire costs that we have as we continue forward. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Bercher.
Senator Bercher.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. First of all, I'd like to make a statement. I think the new funds from the Wildfire Protection Fund was used very wisely, and it made some significant differences in a lot of the stuff I've seen out there. The only comment I really have today, I just like it's something my observation that I've never have really seen in all the years I've been doing this, and that is I'm seeing a lot of fatigue. And I think that's because this season just rolled right, last season just rolled right into this, and I've seen, and I'm not talking about fatigue from somebody working 14 hours a day. I'm starting to see, maybe it's career fatigue, where people, where some of the folks, private sector, your sector, and the federal sector, I'm actually hearing from people that they're just starting to get burned out. Mm-hmm. No pun intended, but and I hope we're starting to be conscious of that and how to. I don't know if you're starting to see that, it's just, you know, you could. It's one thing to run a race; it's another thing to run a race every day, and I think that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And I hope we become conscious of that. Because it's starting to. I've never seen that in all the years, and it's over three decades for me. And I'm really seeing that, so I just wanted to bring that up today.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes.
I'm just
Representative Holby.
Yeah, thank you. I'm curious about the Yellow Point fire, which is, I remember the Oxbow fire as a kid, and it was, you know, a big event around my neighborhood. And this is in the same area, and I'm just, you know, what's going on there? Because that's a scary area to watch burn. I think the Roseburg Forest Products, you know, Dave Cramsey has sent me some emails off and on, and so is Link Smith down there doing a great job keeping us informed. But it's a really scary area because those forests are now 50 years old after that Oxbow burn. And so what's the status of that one?
Sure. Chair Roblin, Senator Hovey, I appreciate that question. The Yellow Point Fire is just west of Eugene, and it started very close to, actually within probably a half mile of where the 1966 Oxbow Fire burned over 42,000 acres. On this fire, as you've already mentioned, Roseburg Forest Products, as well as Seneca, and along with the Department of Forestry and some of the local fire departments, provided aggressive initial attack on what appears to be another human-caused fire. We mobilized one of our incident management teams, and that fire stands today right at around 750 acres. Yesterday it was 85% contained and was transitioned to a smaller team where one of the local ODF employees has taken over and basically finishing up gritting that fire, and should be at 100% today or within the next few days. But a serious amount of risk on that fire. It started during the east wind event, I think it was last weekend, and just great kudos to the group of folks that got together and put that out. Landowners were key in providing the equipment and support and opening roads.
Thanks. Senator Burdick.
Thank you. I had a couple questions. One is on the, you mentioned the Moccasin fire was human caused, and I heard on the radio that this new fire in Estacada has been human caused. When they say human caused, what is it usually the cause?
Chair Roblin, Senator Burdick, human-caused fires can really be a variety of things. In the early spring and the fall, when we talk about human-caused fires, it's oftentimes a backyard debris burning that gets away from folks. We have a lot of recreational-type fires. I know that the fire up north here just out of Estacada, it's been in the news multiple times that there's the investigation is, or at least publicly talking about the potential for some the cause of that being from the use of firearms, shooting target at a target range. But until they fully do the investigation, that would be to be determined. But those are some examples of typically the type of human-caused fires that we get. Unfortunately, this year, some of the human-caused fires that we have had have just been on some of the very worst burn-type day conditions with winds that we could have had. And as a result, a number of those have gotten large this year and frankly, created a lot of the loss within, you know, structures, residences, et cetera.
Another question, if I could, Mr. Chair. You mentioned how they dump all these buckets of water on, but I always see on the news where this red fire retardant, they dump that, and that looks very, very scary to me from an environmental standpoint. Do we use that in Oregon, and what are the environmental consequences of those retardants?
Chair Roblin, Senator Burdick, yes. Essentially what you see there on the news, typically, we have four air tankers under the statewide severity program that do drop retardant, and it is a safe combination of chemicals and water that basically slows the spread of fire. And obviously, even though it's as safe as possible, all parties using that, not only the Department of Forestry but the Forest Service, basically strive to not have that enter into any water stream. So that's always taken into consideration.
And what would happen if it dropped on my head?
You would get some red-looking goo on you, and you'd take a shower and be just fine. If it dropped on you, you're probably going to be very happy that it was there because you were in the wrong place at a very bad time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nancy, I want to follow up on what Senator Burdick had, because I was going to ask more in a legal way. Of these human-caused fires, have they all been negligence-based, or has there been anything showing that anything's been intentional?
Chair Roblin, Senator Prozanski, great follow-up, and I probably should have gotten further into that. In state law, the Department of Forestry is required, and we do investigate every fire start that we have. And that connects to other pieces of law that requires us to go after fire cost recovery if there is negligence, and that can be negligent by the public and or a landowner. So in any one of these right now, unfortunately, investigations take quite some time, but we have a history of accomplishing fire cost recovery on many, many different types of fires. And so as those become known as a result of this summer, I'd be happy to follow up with you on that, as well as give you examples of fires where we've had, you know, millions of dollars in fire cost recovery.
That's fine. I guess really the other part of that question, though, has there been anything documented for this year, as there has been in the past, where someone has intentionally started the fire?
Oh, Chair Roblin, Senator Brzezinski, in terms of any verified arson-type behavior, there is suspect in multiple locations this summer of arson-type fires in eastern, south, central Oregon, as well as in southwest, and even more recently, just east of here. So there are ongoing, there's ongoing coordination between various law enforcement entities, as well as our own investigators. And to date, I am not aware of any arrests this summer.
So, Mr. Chair, if we could have a follow-up either December or January, that would be great.
Yeah, if you get back to us, let us know when you have the information. That would be great.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to commend the Department of Forestry. I think you've done a very insightful presentation. I feel like you're managing in a very difficult situation. You're managing really well. And, you know, I salute you. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll pass that along.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it a lot. And we'll get back to you with regard to more information on biomass.
Very good.
And
thanks,
we're going to take a little pause while the next group comes up.
Thank you.
So.
That sounds great. Thank you.
You. We're going to bring us back to order, and our next presentation is going to be about, let me get this in front of me so I can say this right. Where's my mining window? Mining regulations, and so we'll let those people clear a little bit. And I want to thank Senator Brzezinski for coming up and asking for this particular deal. I'll let you say a couple things before we're going
to
start, and we're going to start with our Department of Geology, but I'll let Senator Brzezinski begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just want to, I guess, kind of put on the record. I asked for this not to be pointing fingers at anyone, but instead to try to have an attention to look at what and review our current policies and regulations. My goal is to open up the discussion for updating our policies and fitting today's culture, taking in consideration that many of the policies we currently have did not take in consideration what we're currently seeing in our culture and society today. And our goal is to try to make certain that we have an interface that will have good neighbors on all parts. We can continue the industry and stuff like that, but I do think that based on what I've seen in our district, and it's just not my district, it's throughout the state that we're seeing where these conflicts have occurred and such, and I just think it's time for us to see if we can't make it a better system than what we have today, and one that's going to still answer the questions that we need for the production of aggregate, etc., but at the same time ensuring that neighbors are not finding themselves in situations that become unhealthy and not a quality of life that we all would like to enjoy.
I really appreciate that, because I am one of those people who really does understand that in our society, we need things like aggregate to make it work, and how we make that stuff work with everybody is really important. And in that line, we have one more addition to our panel today. The new owner of the facility is going to speak at the end, just to say, because I would like to have a conversation start. I mean, that's a big part of it.
And again, Mr. Chair, this is just one situation in one part of the state. And this is, again, I hope that everyone understands this is kind of to open the dialogue. This is not to be, again, pointing fingers or saying something has gone amok in this one particular thing. That just totality, we just need to kind of, just like I think anything that we have, is living, breathing documents, our statutes, and sometimes we just need to look at them, refresh them, update them.
Okay. And with that, we will, our Department of Geology. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Roblem and committee members. My name is Vicki McConnell. I'm the Oregon State Geologist and the Director for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. The department, through their Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program, has the task of being the main regulator for mining in the state. And what I'm going to do right now is give you just a very broad overview of what that means, what's the intent for that, what's our goals and purposes with our regulation of mining. I've asked Mr. Gary Lynch, my assistant director, to drill down a little bit more about how that actually occurs quickly in the operation, some of his observations, and some of you folks know Mr. Lynch is almost as old as some of the mines around, and so he has a great insight on that. And so just to really kind of give you the background of how and why we regulate for mining in the state.
Are you saying that he can give us legislative history?
So as the main regulator, the agency that's tasked with that, the purpose for regulation, the intent for regulation of mining in this state is primarily to accomplish a reclamation at the end of the life of mining for whatever the identified secondary beneficial use of that land is. And so we do that with two main parts of that. The first is to condition operating permits for the life of the mine so that we can minimize off-site impacts and maximize the direction of how that mining is going to occur that'll get you to that reclamation for that secondary beneficial use at the end of the life of the mine. The second thing that we do is to calculate and bond, in other words, have financial surety that if for some reason that reclamation doesn't occur through the operator, that the state is not left holding the bag. And so we also hold the bond for whatever it takes, would the calculation be for actually doing the reclamation. So that's the broad overview. The idea is get to the life of the mine, regulate in such an operation with conditions on that operation that you can get to what that secondary reclamation would be at the end of the life of the mine. And that could be over quite a long time. Life of mines can be decades. We do not issue the land use authority. We work in cooperation with whatever the local land use authority is. So it's not our authority nor our within our responsibilities to say whether you do mine there or not. It's just if the land use authority has okayed mining in that particular area, they have to do it to the statewide authority. Land use authority is generally at the city or county level. Those can vary from city to county. It's not exactly the same in every city and county. So we work very closely with the land use authority to make sure that what they are conditioning on their authority will work with how we're going to be conditioning our permitting for the life of that mine. And that's the big, broad overview of what we do. And I'm going to ask Gary to go into a little more detail about how we actually do that in the operation. And we're happy to answer questions at any point in this if you need clarification or more information.
Senator Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and administer the Mineral Land Reclamation and Regulation Program, which is going to be one of the longer titles in the state. And I got to admit that I will not make the next session, which is, first one I'm missing in 15 or 16. But retirement is I'm looking forward. But looking forward is part of what actually I think is the solution to this today. And briefly, and I will be brief, to put what Vicki said maybe in a simpler fashion, whether or not a parcel of land can be mined resides with the land use authority, most commonly the county. Can be the feds, can be cities. And how they mine to obtain that secondary beneficial use resides with Doug Ammey. We have to work, and we do work well with these different counties, but there are 36 counties out there. Many of them are similar, and they all have differences. That said, I think the issue here is one that we're seeing, particularly in natural resource management, of our permits are starting to get old like I am. Decisions that were made 10, 20, 30 years ago and done well, worked hard, don't stand up to the test of time necessarily. We have greater demand for aggregate. We have more population. Population demand equals aggregate demand. So what do we do about that? How do we rewrite history on these? And this is what I think will be interesting to look at. And I think what Senator Przanski said, that we're going to have to look at rewriting statutory language, and some of that may be where the ultimate solution lies. But that is an issue that, and frankly, I don't know how to fix that one, how we do rewrite that history of or clear up our crystal ball for the future. And no matter what whatever I say is easier for me to say than it is for citizens to have to live with that decision. And that's always a rub that government has to deal with. But we are sincere in wanting to fix this problem. Senator Przanski's right. It's statewide. I will say one, the degree that we see on some of the ones in Lane County, they burn white hot when they do occur. And it's understandable. But fixing it is not necessarily easy. So what is the solution? The only I can't get down to the details because I don't know what they are, but it seems to me somehow we have to do a better job of predicting where this will occur. We've started that, and what we've uncovered is it's going to be difficult to look at those. What are the symptoms of these sites that will allow us to come in and fix them? They're relatively small in number, I think, but again, like I say, they burn white hot when they do occur. But being able to predict where they're most likely to happen would then allow us to get to the citizens and say, this is the situation. There is a mine that was zoned in 1978, 1982, and hasn't been used for a long time, but they may start up any time. That would be good to know. If I was buying a house, I'd like to know that. How we get to that point, those are sensitive issues, putting provisions into a real estate deed or something like that. You all know better than I that's tricky sometimes to do. So with that, I don't think I have a whole lot to add other than I think the solution is prediction and also the understanding that our permits and our zoning decisions that were made, again, 10, 20, and 30 years ago need an adjustment.
Okay. Any questions for these two? I do want to say personally, we had a mining operation start in Coos Bay a few years ago called ORC, Oregon Resource Corporation, mines chromite sand. And they just received the Oregon Department of Geology's Mine Land Reclamation Outstanding Reclamation Award and for 2013. And watching their operations and understanding how they've done it and putting it back is pretty impressive. And to be recognized by you is really helpful, I think, to our community. So I just say thank you for that. And thanks for having those kinds of awards to let people know when people are doing it right and
absolutely.
And acknowledging it. So I appreciate that, too.
And Chair Roblin and committee members, I think what you're going to hear next is a specific example of where there's been tension here on this between the mining activity and the local folks. And so this is the when we talk about this, we're making allusion to this example where you're going to hear from the folks right now about that, where it is something they're dealing with and that we're working, you know, attempting to work through with them and with the county on how can we have all these multiple activities happening adjacent to each other.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Berkshire.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. You mentioned Delgami, and I thought maybe you should educate this panel a little bit on what Delgami is and what they do and where they come from.
Well, I know who's going to answer that question, Senator Brushiger, but and that's sitting next to me. All as I know is when we're all done, spell it backwards and see what you get.
Senator Borchardt. Well, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries has two phases to the mission. One of them is really looking at we actually look at the resource assessments. We look at geologic hazards. We look at the science of the geosciences and provide that information for the state. And then our second primary program is the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation, which is responsible for regulating mining, as we've explained, also oil and gas and geothermal exploration and production drilling for the state. So appreciate the opportunity to clear that up.
Follow up?
Yes.
Could you tell them what they do, though, what Dalgami does, how they do that?
Well, Chair Roblem and Senator Barshiger, we do a lot of things. You're leading me somewhere, and I'm not sure where. Okay, so one thing I will say is we are a very field-oriented agency, both in our regulatory and in our science. I mean, we are applied science, and we have a lot of folks out there on the ground doing a lot of geoscientific mapping, information gathering, and working in the field, and particularly with our reclamationists. We look at trying to identify where the problems are and work on the field and in the field to solve them before we end up litigating our way into
it. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Don't know if I've answered your question yet.
That's okay. It's good. Alex Kyler from Lane County.
Good morning, Chairman Roblin and members of the committee. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I'm the county's sort of jack of all trades and master of none. I've brought Matt Laird with me, who's our Land Management Division Manager. Matt's among a number of responsibilities, oversees the permitting process for hard rock mining and aggregate sites in Lane County. So I think he'll do a better job of sort of setting the context for our role with respect to the operations that we are in partnership with Dalgami and other state agencies in making sure, trying to manage that primary land use of the site and mitigate any conflicts with the surrounding land use of the neighbors. And I think what you've heard from the agency immediately prior to this is a good sort of overview of Lane County burning white hot. I've seen in my 8 years as the county's intergovernmental relations manager sort of a series of very complicated and intense issues between neighbors and mining operations. I think for the most part, the well-established mines, you've seen a very large mine, if you go through Eugene Springfield on I-5, the Springfield Quarry has operated for years and years pretty flawlessly. We've got a number of other multi-generational family-owned mines that have run very flawlessly. I think where we get into problems are starts and stops and project-oriented mining operations that start and stop for a specific project. And some of those transfers of ownership is where we see some stickiness, if that sort of helps frame the potential for solutions. I'm going to turn this over to Matt and let him speak, but I do want to, after he's done, describe for the committee two bills that we worked on last session that did not advance. I'm hopeful that this committee could entertain those bills again. They have been drafted, and I'll describe those as soon as Matt's done.
Good morning, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm here today to explain some of the state and local land use rules pertaining to mining regulations and how they work. It all starts with the statewide planning goals that were adopted in 1973. Those goals express the state policies on land use. They are achieved by local comprehensive plans and zoning consistent with those goals. Statewide planning goal 5, natural resources, was adopted in 1974, and it pertains to resources such as riparian areas, wetlands, wildlife habitat, natural areas, cultural areas, and mineral and aggregate. So how does a site get on this inventory of significant aggregate sites at the local level? Well, we follow the Oregon Administrative Rules 660-016 and 660-023. The Goal 5 process, and I'm doing quite a summary here. It's much more complicated than that. But the Goal 5 process generally is you collect data on location, quality, and quantity of the resources. You prepare an inventory of those significant and important sites. You identify conflicting uses that might conflict with the Goal 5 resource. In this case, the Goal 5 resource we are talking about is the mineral and aggregate. You conduct an ESEE analysis, which is information pertaining to economic, social, environmental, and energy consequences. Based on this ESEE consequences, jurisdictions provide reasons for making a decision to either not include the site on an inventory, delay the site from being added to the inventory pending additional information, or to include the site on a final plan inventory. Once the local jurisdiction has determined the sites on the final plan inventory, then they are required to develop a program to achieve the goal. And in this case, the goal is to protect the natural resource site. And in this case, it would be to protect the mineral and aggregate site. Once you protect the resource site, the jurisdiction determines the resource is of such importance that it must be protected from encroaching conflicting uses. The program to protect the resource was identified in the comprehensive plan of Lane County that it was a significant mineral and aggregate resource site, and at that point you either choose to zone it sand and gravel or quarry mining, depending on the type of site. The sand and gravels are typically in your lowland floodplain areas along rivers, and your quarry mines are typically your upland hard rock mines. In this case also, when this was happening, they were making the decision to either include the site within the urban growth boundary or not include it. So that's also one of the things that they were looking at that time, and it was chosen not to be included. In the Saginaw case, there wasn't an urban growth boundary close by, but in some of our other cases, we have had urban growth boundaries very close. Public hearings were held on these sites in the early 1980s, and in this case, on September 12, 1984, pursuant to Lane Code and County Ordinance Number PA 892, the sites were identified as significant and planned and zoned, either sand and gravel or quarry mine, as I mentioned. So in the Lane County code, the next thing it does is it lists the permitted uses, and in this case, sand and gravel operations such as extraction, stockpiling, processing of sand and gravel are permitted use. Asphalt plants, cement concrete plants are also permitted in conjunction with the sand and gravel operation. So we've limited those type of uses to a very few sites allowed in the county. Accessory uses are also allowed, such as equipment storage, trucks, office buildings, maintenance buildings. The next section of the code discusses site improvement standards, and these are the minimum standards to be observed during the extraction process to assure the site will be clean and orderly and left in a condition conducive to appropriate use after the extraction has been completed. It looks at things such as slopes and grading, drainage, retaining at least 4 inches of topsoil for cover, planting of ground cover, maintaining excavation setbacks from 150 feet from the property boundaries. The operational standards are the next piece of our code. They require setbacks from property boundaries of 50 feet as a standard setback. It can go up to 150 feet if it's adjacent to a residence or a rural residential zoning district. Requires road frontage, screen landscaping, maintaining trees and vegetation within 25 feet of a right-of-way or a residential zone to try to buffer the view into the site. Safety fencing is also required within 200 feet of a residence, and it also coordinates with DOGAMI and DEQ regarding maintaining water quality. The next section of our code is on Section 6. It's on performance bonding. It's $500 per acre to also help ensure the site is restored afterwards and the county or the state both aren't left holding the bag on that one. Number 7 is administration. So the administration section is kind of the process. We have what's called a sand and gravel review committee in Lane County, and it's made up of the planning director, the public works director, the park and recreation director, the director of building and sanitation, a hydrogeologist, and a floodplain specialist. And that committee can also appoint advisory board members to be on it as well. That committee is also what reviews the operational standards that I mentioned above. The one thing that should be pointed out is the Sand and Gravel Review Committee can only approve or modify plans. It cannot deny plans. And the reason being is the land use process and land use decision already happened back in the 80s. The sites went through a proper land use process and were approved and allowed to be mined. At this point in time, anything that happens after that is basically a review of how can you operate. Those decisions, of course, can be appealed through our local process, which goes to a hearings official, then to the Board of County Commissioners, and then ultimately to LUBA, the Land Use Board of Appeals. In this case, at the Saginaw case, we had a site that had filed for an application in 2011. We put that application on hold to allow them to go through their DOGAMI process. It really didn't seem like, in this case, that the applicant really knew how to proceed. And by working with DOGAMI, I think that really helped them formulate a real plan of how they were going to mine the site. Ultimately, there was some enforcement action that happened on that site. There was some mining and operations that was happening outside of the parameters of what was approved. That ended up as a settlement in circuit court is how that process ended, and they continue to go through their process with us right now. That is one case of a high-profile case in Lane County. We've recently had several. We've had the Parvin Butte case, which was very large. We've had some issues with Delta Sand and Gravel. We've had one with an Eggy Quarry mine, and then the Saginaw Sand and Gravel. And in several of those cases, as Alex alluded to, the primary conflict is residential to the aggregate operations, and in some of these cases it was the type of sites that had gone through a process in the 80s but either were staying dormant or operating at very low levels, and then due to economic forces and things changing, they ramp up their operation, and neighbors say, wow, that is not how it's been for a while, and so then the conflicts arise. So that is the end of my presentation.
Alex?
Thank you. So committee members, Alex Kyler again. We ran two bills last session that we sort of felt like, given our experience, especially with the Parvin Butte startup again, that we felt might be beneficial. The first bill was House Bill 3298, and what that bill attempted to do was to improve the communication between, specifically between DOGAMI and the local government. The process is dissimilar from other state agencies where an applicant typically goes. When they go to the state says, well, you go to the county first, bring us a land use compatibility statement that outlines so that the agency is ensured that the land use is appropriate. The DOGAMI example is more that the applicant goes to DOGAMI first, DOGAMI contacts the county and asks for to ensure that the land use is appropriate and to ask us how much time we need. We felt like this bill would have created a land use compatibility statement-like process for DOGAMI as well. And the benefit there is that with the applicant coming to the county first, Match Shop gets to actually sort of assign that person a customer number. We can actually bill them for that time that they've encountered, and we're aware and have a dialogue with the applicant about what's occurring and can send that person along to DOGAMI armed with that information. And we just think that this is sort of a more consistent policy and will improve communications between the agency and the county. The the upshot was that we worked with the agency as this bill was being introduced and felt like the legislation wasn't going to be necessary because we thought we would be going into a rulemaking process with the agency. That didn't occur, and in the meantime, we sought to get the bill reintroduced just to have it as an insurance policy. There may be other non-legislative fixes. The second bill was House Bill 3299, and as Assistant Director Lynch alluded to, is a potential solution, and it had to do with real estate notification upon sale. So when you're selling a piece of property, there is this thing called the seller's disclosure list. Typically, that involves things that are internal to your property, whether you've done any modifications, whether there's been a certain inspections, and the seller, you know, checks off whether all this whole list of things that they are aware of that have occurred on the property. We were suggesting a new category, which would be, does that property exist within a mile of a Goal 5, identified Goal 5 mineral resource area? Sort of a buyer beware type of approach, not dissimilar to, you know, sort of thinking about some of the conversations that have occurred in the building in terms of Code of the West or existing law that addresses how folks can or can't complain about operations on exclusive farm use and forestry operations. So seems like a fairly decent idea. Obviously, it's relating to seller's disclosure. Real estate industry not crazy about that, opening up that sort of thing, and that bill failed to advance. But it may be a solution that sort of gets at least having this notification to folks who are buying a house. We noticed in the Parkman Butte case especially that there were people who said, I had no idea that mountain was going to be a mine when I purchased the property. And so that's sort of what we were attempting to do there.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the, yes?
Sure, just to clarify, Parkman Butte is an area that's just outside of Eugene to the southeast, outside of Dexter. And it's another area within my district, just like the Saginaw. But I think we just need to put that on the record as to what it is, since it's
right.
Something different. But
right.
Again, that's how these type of scenarios have come to my attention, based on the reopening or activity. Not, I mean, they're both different as to what they did, but
right.
This is one.
Yeah, appreciate that. Yes.
Chairman Roblin, Senator Przanski, and that particular mine was open for the purposes of building the Outlook Reservoir Dam.
Right.
It's sort of an interesting case in that it's very high quality rock. It's adjacent to a Union Pacific rail line, and so it does have some attributes that make it sort of attractive when the marketplace dictates that it could be there. And in fact, I think that it sort of has a connection to the coast because it's been thought about as being a place
Jetty
to
rock.
Put to
Jetty
bring
rock.
Good.
Jetty Rock.
Jetty Rock, yeah, because the quality.
Yeah, and obviously, from the sounds of it, when Lane County was permitting this and doing their land use planning, they recognized it as a high-value material that could be used for those things. So they went through the process appropriately at the time. It's just been a long time since they used it, which makes it a difficult deal.
That's true, Chairman Roblin. That was also the example where we, of course, the county's been a Timber
right.
County hard hit. We've had a lot of reorganization in a match shop. We missed the mail from Dogami suggesting, do you have this time?
Okay.
They took it as, well, we didn't hear back from the county, so we'll do the sort of the abbreviated process, and that's how House Bill 3298 came about. We were sort of going, wow, in this new world of shrinking county services, it would have been better in that case had the applicant come to us first, gone to Dogami with this Lux-like statement, and everybody would have been better informed
right.
in that process.
Thank you very much. So with that, we have a group of core Saginaw neighbors. How you want to organize yourself, come on up and...
to impose that.
That'd be perfect.
Requirement.
And again, we're going to... The actual committee is supposed to get over at 11. We will give you some extra time. I will stay, and whoever needs to go can go.
Thank you.
I've got a meeting.
I think we're okay.
busy couple of days.
Okay, so in the interest of brevity.
Okay, thank you.
While these folks are setting up, I'll introduce myself. My name is Scott Byler. I'm a resident of Lane County in the Saginaw community. And I do want to thank you, Chairman Roblin, and committee members for having us here. This is really telling as far as citizen involvement. I'm going to be speaking here a little bit. These folks here, other community members, will in turn introduce themselves or be introduced with just a brief statement as far as personal experiences. We're here at Senator Przanski's invitation, and I'm going to, first let me say, on this map on the far end here, this is a map of the Saginaw community. I hope you can see it from there. We don't have a laptop in hand. What you'll see there is in the gray is the currently zoned sand and gravel area. About two-thirds or three-quarter of that is limited exemption. It's an old mine. The rest is what they're applying for as a new mine. The yellow dots on all those parcels there are residences of various sorts, and you can see there's a lot of them. This is a community of several hundred people. Many, many homes, many of which border exactly on that. And so this ties back to what somebody said earlier about things changing over time. I'm here to represent this community of several hundred to give you information for use in reforming mining laws. I do think, like the Senator Przanski said, it's time for some changes. This is in the interest of not just benefit to ourselves, but across the state, other people will and have experienced these same experiences. We look to the future legislation to create a balance between mining, residential, agricultural. I'm going to talk a little bit about history of mining in Saginaw. And unfortunately, this is not intended to be a whining session, but our recent experiences do, we need to bring out some of what we actually experienced as people and as residents to kind of highlight some of the problems that we have with current processes. And then we'll talk a little bit about what we see that might enhance our processes around mining. From a history standpoint, the mining in Saginaw dates back to at least the 1950s. It's always been there. It's been a part of the community. Most of the folks know it's there. It's been operating at a small level. And many of the people, community members, have actually worked there. So it's a known entity in the way that it was. It used to operate at two or three trucks a day or no trucks or, like somebody else said, very small. It was also brought up here that a lot of the problems occurred due to change, to a ramp-up, and that is certainly what happened in 2011, is there was a ramp-up. Big business pretty much moved in overnight without notification to the county. I think very little interaction with Dogami. They already had a limited exemption, so they didn't need new permits, is my understanding. The difference is that they operated at what had to be a thousand-fold increase in operations. Literally, there's three- and four-story piles of gravel, dump trucks used in strip mining in Montana. They brought in equipment from out of state, crews from out of state, my understanding. Set up operations, set up the asphalt plant, again, without county approval, so forth. Came in 4 months, operated without approvals from the county, without additional permits or controls from Dogami, packed up their equipment and left in September, October. Had to be a multi-million dollar operation, much to the destruction horror of the surrounding community, as I'll describe to you. Just briefly, asphalt plant was installed without county approval. They overran the boundaries of sand and gravel land, opened a closed warehouse or landfill that was to be sealed to contain pollutants, released muddy water into the Coast Fork to the degree that it turned it entirely brown, didn't apply for required permits, built an illegal road over farmland, and used it despite the county's best efforts. Operated without federal contracts for river water, operated at an extreme level that was not sanctioned by the limited exemption if you base it on historic levels. That's the disregard for the legal aspects, disregard for the surrounding community, and somebody said, you know, good neighbors. This has been a gravel pit there for many years. I know that. But there was no apparent effort to control dust and fumes. Excessive noise, it was a contract for I-5 improvements. They operated generally at night, starting up at maybe 5 or 6 and operating until out of the wee hours of the morning. Excessive tractor-trailer traffic, we counted up to 70 trucks per hour. It's a truck a minute and more on our little county road with no shoulders, which goes past the local school, the entrance to the local Head Start school. So there's some background. These pictures that you see, and particularly this one here with the four pictures taken by the Fords, kind of says it all. This is a picture, but go ahead. Corky, you want to speak to that and introduce yourself?
You need to identify yourself. You need to be close enough to the mic or move the mic.
You can set it up on top of the counter there.
Okay.
And it's very sensitive, so you don't need to.
You don't have to be too close.
Okay. Yeah.
That's perfect.
We'll try this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we'll try to keep these comments on these from these individuals down to a minute or so.
These pictures were taken.
Your name?
Name.
My name is Corky Ford.
Thanks.
And these pictures were taken from our front porch. 6 o'clock at night until 6 in the morning, this is what we had all summer long. Nobody needs that in their backyard. That's an oil tanker. He's going by that gentleman's house that is 35 feet away from his home. All of these people, they've all been touched by this. And it's an asphalt plant that just, in my understanding, has never been there before. And I would never want that for anybody, ever.
Okay, thanks, Corky. Again, I touched briefly on the map on the far side showing the location of the mine in the middle of our community, which is a general store, two mills, a church, and a school, and a lot of residences. I'd like to, if you have those photos over here on my left, you see photos, the map in the middle. In the center of that is those ties that go out to those various pictures. Those pictures show the proximity of the mine boundaries to existing residences. And if you want to go ahead and pull that, show the next one, David. So here is the driveway, essentially, to Wendy's home. And you see where that big arrow points on the left is a stake, survey stake, marking the boundaries of the gravel mine.
This is the beginning of my property.
The beginning of her property there with the home, and there's the stake.
My property goes to this side.
And the next picture, it's just another similar picture, just saying that this is maybe not the best place for huge operations. You see the fence line, again, the two red arrows marking the stakes. In the background at the top right, you see somebody's home. That's got to be 35 feet.
And behind that fence, there is a house as well.
So it brings into questions, you know, maybe things have changed over time. Diana, do you want to speak to your experience in trying to find help?
I will. So I'm Diana Michaels, and I live at 80284 Delight Valley School Road, and it's a privilege to come before you and tell you what we've gone through somewhat. On the map, you'll see there is one home that's right on the, and I'll see if I can get there, right on the edge, and that's where I live. So what happened for me right here is that within this, there was the grandfathered area, and our local commissioner asked me to go out and find what the operation had been 50 years ago when it was working. I did that. However, thereafter, no one came back and used that information. Can you hear me all right?
Well, it's not us hearing. It's the
recording.
It goes on the record.
Yeah. Okay, I thought it was loud. But that's what everybody tells me, right? So within that gray area is both the existing gravel site and a proposed new expansion. So it's moving closer even to the houses than it used to be. The fact of the matter was our local commissioner asked that I go out, find what the grandfathered operation was, and give it back to him so that he could have that as record of, you know, there were no night events. There were no trucks to that extent. There was no asphalt. None of those things. I did that, and yet that information was never used by anyone for whatever manner that was. And it is over 50 years old. So it's not just that it goes to 1984. It goes beyond that, and it's a grandfathered situation. One of the things that happened for us was that in the middle of a night in the summer, it was either June or July, the trucks started rolling down this newly made road through agriculture to get out to the road that we had no idea of. And rock crushing began, and backup beepers or whatever they are were going off. And it was, no one ever came to our door, to our community, to anybody and say, okay, this thing that has sat dormant is now going to have a new life, and this is what you're going to experience, and this is how we're going to work with it. And that would have been greatly appreciated.
This is the road you're talking about?
Yes. The last thing that I think is really important is that real estate revision law, because when most of us bought our houses, we were told that this is an exhausted or, you know, done gravel site, which obviously if someone newly buys it and uses it, it is not. So we were under no knowledge that this was going to happen, because we bought in between the time that it never ran, and in between the time, even though we've been there 15 years, in between the time that it had run, at just a normal mom and pop level. So that's my concern.
Thanks. Thank you. And Dwayne, could you speak just briefly to the truck traffic?
My name is Dwayne Charters, and I own the property.
You're good. You can stand up. It's fine.
80184 Delight Valley School Road and 80186. And this is my property and my two houses here. This road was non-existent when my grandparents bought the property 60 years ago. And so when I moved on the property and I built a house in 2010, there weren't 70 trucks per hour going past my front door 100 feet away. And asphalt fumes everywhere, gravel fumes, truck fumes, all of this was happening. I couldn't get sleep for 2 weeks because I had to get used to the noise that was never there. So one thing is just, it's just crazy that people can just build illegal roads right in front of your house that, yes, I knew there was a gravel site 2,000 feet away from my house that I never noticed until they built this road right in front of my front door. And okay. So I think that is what, you know, would really like some legislation about, that people can't just build brand new things in front of people's houses that never existed. And
not tell you.
And just continue to do it with disregard of all the community members that that had this place here for 60 years and never saw this kind of operation.
Okay, Dwayne, let me move on here. And Wendy, can I skip on by?
He's got a mic anyway. There, yeah.
I would just like to say that I brought...
And your name?
And you are?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Wendy Hitchcock. I live at 80063 Horn Lane. I've lived there for 30 years. Coincidentally, I just found out that the month that I moved onto my property is the month that they decided that area would be sand and gravel area. The old woman is passing out both my testimony to the Lane County Board of Commissioners when we all attended a meeting, and my letter that I sent to Senator Prozanski, and I'd like to thank you very, very much for giving us this time, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I think those two things will probably say it all. There's so much to say, but thank you all very much. I really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
And I had some, you know, went through a logic process that said, well, how could we fix this? How could we really be constructive and work with the state to address some of these things we see as issues? But I want to diverge from that just a little bit, because, and just speak from the cuff, our experience in calling for help and calling our county commissioners or our county departments and talking to Dugami and talking to El Rapa was that nobody quite knew who was responsible for which. They pointed fingers to each other. I personally was pointed for the same function to the county and to Dugami. And that's who controls visual barriers for a gravel pit. Okay, so it's apparent that it's not clear. And I think the testimony we had here earlier today kind of highlights that. Dugami, it was interesting for me, said that they are the main regulator. Their purpose is for reclamation 30, 40, 50 years from now. Whose purpose is it for operation? Lane County overlaps with Dugami in a lot of areas. They talked about planting visual barriers, which is in the Dugami permit. They talked about setbacks, which is also in a Dugami permit. They talked about DEQ, somebody I think it might have been Lane County, cited as being responsible for water quality, and yet we've called DEQ regarding documented oil spills and buried tanks on the property with no result. And so the point I'm trying to make is there's not any coordination or delineation of who's responsible for which. Noise appears to be unregulated by the state of Oregon, although OAR 467 grants that the state can control it. OAR 340 says that it's unfunded and they won't control it. Again, that's DEQ. OAR 467.100 gives the county authority to regulate noise, but the county has stated that they don't regulate noise. So nobody regulates. And I guess that's where I'm going with the balance. Mines now have the ability to do what they need to do to make money, pretty much unfettered in practice. And that was demonstrated by the 2011 operation of 4 months without stopping. And the fine levied by Lane County, my understanding, was $4,000. And this is on a multi-million dollar, had to be millions of dollars.
Which became a donation.
Which became a donation to the local Head Start school.
So they could get a tax.
Okay, so anyway. I did provide the lady here with recommendations from the group as to how some of the things we might look at is if we look at changing the laws surrounding mining. I think there's four items. If we improve definition of the responsibilities of each agency, and I won't belabor that, I talked about it some, because right now nobody knows who's doing which. Provide for citizen recourse in the event of mining violations or agency inaction. The citizens in our area are unable to get response by and large. And again, here I want to stop for a moment and say I really appreciate the work that Senator Przanski has done and Dugami has done recently. Yes. It's been some great work towards the new permit, which has involved citizens. And it's refreshing. They took our input and they did things with it. And we recognize the need for gravel. We don't want to eliminate gravel mining. We're just looking for that balance. So I do want to thank those folks for the work that has happened since 2011. Clearly define limited exemption areas as at historical levels. This is one that we never had an opportunity to test, but I think that's what it says. But, if it was clearly delineated as it can continue to operate at the level it was grandfathered in, that's fine. It's been a part of our community for half a century, but not four-story high piles of gravel and asphalt. And then again, just to balance the mining, the citizens, and agriculture. And I've used up plenty of your time, unless you folks have something to add. Oh, this you also have a copy of. This is the letters from the letters from community members. There's some 40 or 50 or something in their own writing on their own computers. If you have a chance, please do review
impact.
That.
Yes, and we just went door to door and asked people if they would like to attend a meeting and write a letter, and we got 70 people there, and then we were fortunate to have Senator Przanski and Commissioners and Dugami come for a second meeting and let us express our concerns, and we're very appreciative for all that you've done, and Dugami and the county.
And I would like to emphasize that we're coming at this from a constructive standpoint. We recognize gravel mining. We'd like to work with the state, with the mining company and the county in a way that is productive for all of us and creates a balance.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I do appreciate the tenor with which you approach this and all of the stuff. So I thank you for that very much. So with that, we're going to invite up Rich Engstrom and as these guys leave, and you can introduce your...
Good morning. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I'm going to do an introduction, but if I can just make four policy points that I think are important. But I do first want to say that we're hearing the neighbors. You know, from OCAPA's perspective, we're always preaching good neighbor policies and good communication. It's a foundation of our organization and what we ask folks to do. As far as members, just because, as you know, when you're doing a highway project at night, and that's how the contracts are now, just a simple communication about what's going on goes a long ways from just the company to alleviate a lot of this, that they know it's temporary and that the backup beepers are actually for the safety of the workers required by the federal government. You know, just some simple things that the owners should have done in this circumstance, and it's kind of unfortunate that they got put through this without the owners doing that. It's more inconsiderate than the way, you know, good operation behavior goes. But the one thing I do want to say, just from the policy perspective, is before I introduce Katie Jeremiah, who's one of the new owner of the Parvin Butte, not the Saginaw, but the Parvin Butte quarry. But aggregate is a protected statewide resource. It's so important that the legislature, through the Gold Fire process, has said we're going to protect it, and not only that, we're going to protect it against the land uses around it. One of the failings in the system is we have continued to allow housing to encroach upon mine sites, and we haven't protected those old mine sites from, you know, the encroachment of housing. And this is a residential conflict for the most part. The second thing is mining activity cycles with the economy, and especially aggregate, and actually Oregon Resources Company. They've had to stop mining right now. Their warehouses are full. There's just not a demand. And that really is true in aggregate. With the economy slowing down, first thing that slows down is aggregate, and we all know that. It just is kind of a common sense thing. So we are kind of a periodic and sporadic, and that actually lends itself to some of the residential conflicts as people come in, they get used to it being quiet, and then all of a sudden it's active again. Not every site is like a wilder site or, you know, something that's just consistent all the time. The third policy that's important is the permits are life of mine. And when we go through that process, the way we design mines is it's very engineered. It takes a lot of agencies involved. Folks forget there's multi-state agencies that permit these things, multi-county agencies and local governments, and the federal government. You would not believe the permits that we have to go through. So once we go through that, there is a huge investment. One mine site, over $10 million. It took in order for that site to get finally approved through the planning process. Once that's done, it's kind of set how it goes, and they follow that mine plan, and so we protect those mine, those permits are life of mine. We don't go in and continue to change them because the cost just becomes exorbitant for the owner. And the last thing I want to say is at this point, this isn't a shared bill by OCAPA and OGAMI, is all the legacy sites are identified, and we stopped any. We gave them a couple of years, a few years ago. Some of you have been around long enough, you'll remember the bill, where they had a few years to come in and say, hey, we're a legacy site. We're going to continue to operate. Those are identified in a map at OGAMI. I'm not saying that there aren't still going to be conflicts, but we did try to end more surprises through legislation. So I'm open for questions on this. I appreciate the neighbors coming in from the industry side of things. This is a non-OCAPA member, but I'm sure it will cause OCAPA to have a conversation with this individual. But with that, on the Parvin Butte, because we didn't know what site it was, we know it's been the Parvin Butte for a couple of sessions now. Katie Jeremiah, I'd like to introduce her from Aggregate Resources Company. She's the new owner, and she's going to talk about what she's doing from a good neighbor side of things.
Thank you, Rich. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come in at the last minute and speak on this. As Rich mentioned, I'm one of the owners of Aggregate Resource Industries, and we're in Springfield, Oregon. I own the company alongside my brother, Chris, and it was founded by our father in 1978, and it actually generated out of the logging industry, selling heavy logging equipment, and has since evolved into a contract drilling, blasting, and portable crushing company. And our business travels all throughout the Western United States to do specialty blasting projects for everything from wind farm development to specialty highway projects to residential subdivision, utility work, kind of the whole gamut, including quarry mining. And recently, within the last couple of years, we've been identified as a company who's interested in getting more into the retail market of quarry mining and being able to provide rock resources to the community and for public works projects. And because of our expertise in blasting and close proximity to residential neighborhoods and our relationships with the customers throughout Oregon and the Western United States, the owners of Parvin Butte Quarry approached us and said, you know, we've got this extremely high quality resource, but we don't have people with the expertise to operate it. Would you be interested? And so we have since entered into an exclusive lease arrangement with the owners, and we operate that site now. And something that I just wanted to approach the committee with is that we are absolutely committed to being a good neighbor in this community. We want to be, you know, a good community steward, as well as with the quarry operations. One benefit that we have is that because we are pretty vertically integrated, we are specialists in drilling, blasting, and rock crushing. We don't contract any of that out. There's no finger pointing. If a neighbor has an issue, they can call me, they can call my brother, they can call my mother, and we'll address that issue head on. And we are proactively trying to identify the concerns that made this site so contentious before our arrival. I've actually met with Mr. Balzer that's sitting behind us at Dog Yammy, and he's filled me in on some of the neighbor concerns. We're evaluating things to eliminate noise from backup alarms, such as proximity sensing backup sensors. We have the top technology to control vibration within blasting and to monitor any concerns that the residences there may have. As far as hours of operation, although there are no county restrictions on the hours of operation, we're committed to being a good neighbor. The first project that we've had come out of there, Wildish, actually used for the improvements to Highway 58 this summer, and they originally would like to have operated 24 hours a day because their project on Highway 58 was operating 24 hours a day. But because we're committed to being a good neighbor, we self-imposed a stop time of, I believe it was 6 or 7 p.m., just so that the neighbors didn't have to deal with trucks all night long. And I think without having to do sweeping legislation that affects the entire industry and that in some sites wouldn't necessarily be a good solution, I think if we can identify it on a case-by-case basis, and in our instance, you know, with good communication with the neighbors, you know, we're willing to make adjustments to make it a happy place for all of us and to achieve the goals that we have of providing a great rock resource, lowering the cost of public works projects, providing a resource that neighbors in that area can do their own private improvement at a significantly lower cost because they don't have the expense of trucking it in from Eugene or Oak Ridge. We're just committed to making it something where it's a harmonious relationship with the neighbors and with the operation. So with that, if you have any questions, I'm happy to field those.
Senator Pruszynski.
I thank you, Katie, for coming up and giving us a perspective. I look forward to us sitting down, walking, and working together on some stuff. I guess the thing is what I'm looking at is not per se doing something uniformly across the state that's going to not take in case by case. One of the things I see, Rich, is it seems like we have certain things that are just outright permitted uses, and I think that's at the county level as compared to the state level. What I understand for this Saginaw situation, under Lane County's zoning, if you have a mining aggregate site, it's permitted to come in and just do asphalt there. There's no input.
Sand and gravel.
Sand and gravel, yeah.
sand and gravel, that they can just come in and just actually set up shop and do that as a permitted use as compared to a conditional use. And what I'm hearing Katie says, and watching the neighbors from Saginaw, they're all nodding yes, because you're being a good neighbor. You're basically saying self-imposing, shutting down at certain reasonable hours, et cetera. And to me, maybe some of this stuff just needs to be required to be conditional use that will, in fact, allow for the communities to actually be part of that discussion and decision-making, because it sounds like you, your family, are running a superb operation and really are doing the right thing that we would want as our neighbors. But there are, unfortunately, many, well, I don't say many, there are some individuals that are not doing that, as we can see. And, you know, just the flip side is to someone running an operation illegally, and then for whatever reason, the county either not having the enforcement power or taking their authority and shutting down the operation when they build a road and start operating illegally. Those are the type of things I think that we need to be sitting down looking at and making certain that we have a workable solution for everybody. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Prozanski, we appreciate that, and I look forward to working with you on that. I still think that, you know, it's always hard on both sides at times to legislate good behavior from folks. But I think the notice issue is very important. Mm-hmm. And when people know what's going on, and they know what the expectations and the conclusion dates and it really helps alleviate these kinds of things. And our best operators all sit down with the neighbors and before a big operation, say, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, I mean, the laws are on their side for sure. And I don't know if, when it comes to aggregate, if you want to have a piece of legislation that gives, you know, the residents a kind of a veto right over that. But what you do need to have is good operators that are communicating well and trying to do the right thing and work with the contracts and balance things out. And so we look forward to working with you on that and the neighbors. And you know, from the industry's perspective, that we know that this is we're a contentious industry. We come in, we come in and it's a temporary periodic basis. Every session we have the same kinds of arguments that appear. So, you know, we try to self-impose as best we can, and we look forward to working with Ogami on this and with you. We don't think Lux is on the Ogami permits quite the right approach that Alex was alluding to. So, you know, that's kind of where we're at right now, and I know there's some bills coming, and we look forward to sitting down with folks to talk about them.
Yeah. I will say that I look forward to any of that kind of work. My concern is if, in fact, behaviors on that site were illegal, we need to know who goes in and takes and stops it or does something, because I think that's another issue. And I know your organization doesn't approve of illegal activities. So,
no. Right.
And obviously on that part of the deal, there was illegal activity. Oh, well, we have heard that there was possible illegal activity. There needs to, right, and I don't know, I wasn't there. But we need to have someone who can investigate. We have to figure out who investigates that kind of thing and has the authority to impose sanctions or whatever if, in fact, they are breaking the law, because that's a different thing. If they're exceeding their permits, if they're doing other kinds of stuff, somebody needs to have that. And I think that's something we have to look at.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to close. Rich, I'm not here trying to say the neighbors should have veto rights. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, what I'm looking at is a way that we can sit down and have input, and then whoever are the decision makers have that input, and then they make decisions.
Right.
But it's not going to be that veto right. And what the chair said to me as a prosecutor, if someone's breaking the law like that, you need to be able to hold them with sanctions. $4,000 on a multi-million-dollar project is not, I mean, that's cost of doing business for some people that are just saying, we'll just pay the fine. Or if you have an individual that's basically violating it, you need to be able to have the sanctions, you know, as an attorney, to be able to go to court and actually shut something down that's illegally being done. So that's the type of stuff I think we should be working on.
Chair Roblin and Senator Prozanski. Senator Prozanski knows that we were former prosecutors together,
right.
And we're probably very aggressive against lawbreakers, and we don't condone that at all.
I agree.
For sure. But the same thing is, I don't know enough of the facts,
right.
I certainly will look into them and, you know, find out where they sat in this whole realm of grandfathered. But I do think aggregate permitting and enforcement. You should have sat through some of the mediation sessions with the Farm Bureau a few years ago where Jim Brown was running them. He couldn't believe we could even get through because there's such a mishmash of agencies that are involved in it. So clarity is something that we would actually appreciate.
That's true. We all would. Yes.
Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you, and thank you for coming, and thank for all of you. And we are going to adjourn our interim committee on rural communities and economic development.
We need to get
rural communities and economic development.
We need to get committee on